Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, July 13th, 2013. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. It's a real understatement to say that we're in a moment of history of tremendous change, volatility, turmoil, where virtually every day we see a new atrocity coming out of the White House. In the last week, the president by himself ordered a change in Obamacare without going to the Congress. He's still trying to figure out a way to get weapons to the Syrian terrorists, who are euphemistically called rebels, even though the Congress has moved against that. This is a White House which is, seems to be committed to its own impeachment. And the question is finding some of the people in the Congress who know that this is an unlawful administration who will move to get him out. At the same time, the financial crisis, despite what Bernanke keeps saying and despite the lies in the media about a recovery, it's clear that the reality is that we're on the verge of a catastrophic collapse of food production. The financial system is one unraveling derivative away from a complete collapse, and so on. I could go on and on. This is what we'll be discussing today, but we'll be discussing it from a different standpoint, which is the mobilization of the LaRouche movement internationally, but especially in the United States, to ram through the Congress in the next week or so the policies that will reverse this crisis. And that, and we're in the middle of 2 weeks of action. We finished 1 week last week. We have another week ahead of us, in which our forces are shaping the discussion in Washington. And the discussion is around an end to bailout and bail-in, that is by bringing in Glass-Steagall, and secondly, Glass-Steagall as the entryway for a national banking system of a credit policy and also funding of productive physical economic activity, starting with the North American Water and Power Alliance 21. Now, it's clear that to do this, the Congress is going to have to act and Obama is going to have to go. And that was the central theme of Lyndon LaRouche's weekly webcast last night. And joining us to discuss the webcast and discuss the activity of LaRouche PAC, including this coming week of action, we're really happy to have on the program today Alicia Serratani from LPAC TV and one of the leaders of the mobilization in Washington. And also Rachel Brown is with us. Rachel's a former candidate for Congress in the Boston area. She's the one who probably convinced Barney Frank that he should retire to debating his dining room table. And she's also a member of the LaRouche PAC Policy Committee. So Alicia and Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. Glad to be here.
Well, Alicia, let's start with you because you just finished a week of mobilization in Washington, and you have an overview from your work with LPAC TV on the mobilization nationally. So why don't you give us a quick update on your sense of how it went in Washington this week and then the connection between the on-the-ground activity around the country and what we're doing in Washington.
Sure. Well, last week was, last week, as people know, well, each week, as the listeners may or may not know, there's a team of LaRouche PAC organizers who descend on Capitol Hill and have focused an intensive amount of efforts, mostly on the House side, in creating a buzz, an environment where this just ultimately becomes unbearable for the members of Congress and their staff, where they have to choose which side of history they want to be on. Do they want to be on the American system, Glass-Steagall, big projects, or do they want to continue to be sellouts to Wall Street and the City of London? And we do that by, we have a sort of a three-pronged approach. I mean, people have probably seen the material on the website with banners and being able to intersect the Congress people directly, which generates a lot of work for us because we're able to talk to these people, lay out the program, and then set up meetings with their staff and begin educating their staff.
Alicia, let me ask you on that. We actually are having situations now where congressmen are stopping and talking to us, right?
Well, that's the great thing. We've become somewhat of an institution now in Washington, D.C., right out on Independence Avenue outside of Longworth, where the congressmen come to expect us there. They'll walk up in pairs. What do you have today? What's the latest? What's Mr. LaRouche saying? And the fun thing about the deployment is, you could say it's the same deployment every week, but that's not true, because every time we go there, the Congress has changed because the world has changed, because the crisis has deepened and people are or are not responding to it. So we've become somewhat of an institution. This week was particularly fun because we at the end of the week, we did have the introduction of this bill in the Senate, the 21st Glass-Steagall bill, which really is only going to be as good as we make it. And when I say we, I mean the people in and who support this organization, because we are the only people who have said you need to take on the entire financial system with a systemic reform. And that's the point that we went out with last week. We took the challenge that Mr. LaRouche issued in his weekend shows and said, let's get serious about this issue of credit. Now, there's a high-level discussion about Glass-Steagall going on in the Capitol. Now let's move this a step forward. Let's get these policymakers to understand the principle which really founded the United States, which was what was the driver to create the authority of the federal government and the Constitution. So we had a lot of fun this last week, almost knowing we were headed for a big breakthrough, but like I said, the breakthrough is going to be constantly challenging these guys to get above their level of thinking and saying, you guys have the sovereign authority vested in you to shut down Wall Street. There's really no other power in the world as powerful as the U.S. federal government. And right now, you guys aren't exercising it. And that's why Wall Street, the City of London, are running roughshod over the American people.
Alicia, I think on that, one of the things that we play also as a unique role is cutting through all the lies and confetti about the economy. Because if you look on CNN or Fox or any of them, they accept the idea that there's some kind of recovery. Maybe it's slow, maybe it's sputtering, but the idea that the stock market is up, there are jobs, and they don't look underneath the real figures to find out that what we know, which is that the stock market is a bubble that's going to blow up, that the jobs are mostly low-wage, part-time, short hours, temporary, that the farm sector has been devastated. I mean, last week's program, Marcia Mary went through some of that, some of the presentation she gave in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, which just laid bare the collapse of food production. So this is something we're bringing in. Do you have a sense that we're getting through the inside the beltway haze on this, and that some congressmen are aware that we are facing a systemic devastating crisis?
Frankly, I think the only Congress people who still believe that there is a recovery are people who are in denial that their retirement and stock options are plummeting. I think, to be honest, I think people do understand that there is a systemic collapse, and even Democrats today know that what was pushed through with Dodd-Frank is a joke and didn't fix anything, and are many people are beginning to say this actually might make things worse. And I'll tell you, the American people that we run into there, I'll give you an example. This week we had somebody run up to us from California and say, look, California is the next Greece. You don't understand, we are bankrupt in California. And the way California goes, so goes the nation. And we had securities traders coming up to us saying the worst thing we ever did was repeal Glass-Steagall. So, and I'll tell you, there's a haze in Washington, D.C., but everybody from the congresspeople to people visiting their congresspeople, the lobbyists, even people inside the industry, the financial services industry itself, know that the thing is coming down. And that's made our work incredibly interesting.
Well, that's interesting to hear, because you don't see much of a reflection of it overall, including in what's said by the congressman, because they tend to focus on really narrow parts of it. Now, Joining us also today is Rachel Brown, the former congressional candidate from the Boston area. And Rachel was just deployed today at a Massachusetts Democratic state convention. Rachel, tell us a little bit about the convention today.
Sure. It was a surprise, the responses we got. But we had a petition which was titled, "Glass-Steagall is just the beginning. We need the full Franklin Roosevelt program." It had a short text specifying that we need the original pure Glass-Steagall quickly joined with a policy for generating credit for conscious national development. And we, you know, as Warren just introduced this bill for Glass-Steagall, so we had the intention to make sure that people don't just think that's enough. I'll tell you the truth, because just Glass-Steagall on its own is not enough. You put it through and we're still bankrupt. So we were distributing the leaflet on the Hamiltonian credit system and leading with that idea, yes, Glass-Steagall and Hamiltonian credit. And people would say, well, what is that? And you'd give them a sense of it, and they were very intrigued. We got out tons of platforms. One woman said that her son is studying this. He'll be so happy to get it because he's been trying to figure out what's going on with the entire economy. We had probably at least 10 people, march right up to the table and say the Glass-Steagall is the most important issue. And we had people signing up that have seen us at every convention and were, extremely happy to see us again because we actually had something substantive to say. So we ended up getting about 150 signatures. It was a pretty successful deployment.
Now, the signatures were on the call for Glass-Steagall plus a Hamiltonian credit policy?
Yes. And we were telling people that we were bringing this directly into Congress next week to kick their butts. And there was a lot of support for that idea, that even though this was a Democratic convention, these people are political, there was state reps and congressmen walking around all over the place. To tell you the truth, they know that they're not going to do it. So they would say, well, I don't know, it's going to be tough getting Congress to do anything, but good luck. And they could just, they understood that we had a certain message that most other people weren't willing to fight for.
So there was and a Rachel, lot of, you're, lot of respect. You're going to be going with the policy committee, the LaRouche-PAC policy committee, to Washington, D.C. this next week. I expect there'll be some meetings with congressmen and congressional offices for you guys.
Yep. Yeah, we've been having some of our contacts call and set up meetings. We'll be having some meetings there.
And let me just ask you also, I haven't followed it specifically, but I don't think Massachusetts has a Glass-Steagall memorial resolution yet. Is that something we're still working on?
We are. We've had a bit of a problem that goes back to the days of the British and Wall Street, but we did just recently find out that there is such a thing as a citizen's bill where a citizen can get a signature from a lawmaker and submit their own bill. So we have a number of activists that have already been collecting signatures for Glass-Steagall. So we're working on that and have a target of getting one through next week. We're going to have a week of action, another day of action in the State House next week with our activists. So that's our next goal.
Well, Alicia, let me ask you, because I know you were working the phones the last couple of days, what can our listeners do to aid the mobilization in Washington? And by the way, let me just say that it's not just in Washington, because we are visiting congressional offices, we're calling congressional offices around the country. But what could people do this week to help make this week of action a full success?
Well, the audience and people who have been following the LaRouche-PAC activity in Washington, D.C. should call up their congressperson, call up their two senators, and demand that they take a meeting with one of the members of the LaRouche-PAC Policy Committee. We'll have all six of them in Washington, D.C. This team, which includes Rachel, represent really an incredible proportion of the American people, and we know that because we've organized in, I mean, not only do we have nearly half the country where the state legislatures have introduced resolutions in support of our policy of Glass-Steagall, but we've organized throughout the country on the three-point policy, and you know, all walks of life, all ages, say, yes, this is what my congressperson's not doing. Yes, this is what the president's not doing. I want to support this. So this next week, you will have representation in Washington, D.C., and demand that your congressperson meet with us. If you get a meeting, just contact us. The contact information's on the website. And we've been, that approach has been very effective in the last couple of months. And it's had the effect of these congresspeople and their staff thinking that there are thousands of us out there, which, you know, ultimately, honestly, is the truth. There are hundreds of thousands of people, of Americans, who want to go back to work and who want to fight to do that. And, you know, our LaRouche PAC policy committee is at the front line of that, and we're going to be leveraging all the power we can this week in Washington. And I'll say it's important for people to understand the significance of bringing these guys in this week and these 2 weeks of action is for reasons that Mr. LaRouche has stated in the last couple of days, that because these four senators, Warren, McCain, Cantwell, and Angus King, have introduced this 21st century Glass-Steagall bill, if we don't come in there and have a show of force, leveraging the power and support of the American people, of state legislatures, of Farm Bureau members, of your average, you know, your average person on the street, if we don't go in there and leverage that power, Wall Street will come in and make a mess out of this proposal, out of this bill. And that's what we aim to do, is overwhelm those forces. And I think we can do it by bringing in the policy committee next week into D.C.
Well, the Financial Times already had an article today on the new bill that was just introduced over the last couple of days, the Warren, McCain, Cantwell bill. And they quoted specifically a banking lobbyist and a financial officer from J.P. Morgan talking about why this is a mistake and it's not necessary. But let me just ask you to take this one step further. When you go into these offices, Alicia, are you finding that people are aware that they're getting calls and that it's that when people do make a call, it has an impact?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've done a lot of work in the Congress, and I'll tell you one instance in particular. We walked in, and the staffer sitting at the door answering the phone call, we gave him a quick briefing, said, is this staff person here? We need to meet with him on this. And as soon as we said Glass-Steagall, the young staffer said, "Oh, yes, Glass-Steagall. That's what Mr. LaRouche wants us to pass, isn't it? I've been getting calls about this." So these staffers are. I mean, they talk amongst themselves, but they are absorbing the brunt of this outrage of the American people. And when people call with a plan, these staffers get it. They get it's not just a complaint about a stoplight. It's not a complaint about this. You know, and people are, you know, honestly upset out there. But when people call in with a policy and tell these offices what to do, these staffers, some of them, will get in line and say, yes, this is what we're supposed to do. And it's a species difference of mobilization, and it is, in the Congress as well. I mean, they see us. When we're out there as a banner, they say, yes, I saw you back in my district. Yes, yes, I know Glass-Steagall. It's absolutely having an effect.
Well, I think Lyndon LaRouche last night in his webcast, and by the way, for those who are new to this program, every Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Lyndon LaRouche is doing a webcast where he takes a handful of selected questions and develops his ideas for how to change history. And in his discussion last night, he threw a bit of a ringer in there because most people are hostile to the Congress. You know, the Congress has popularity ratings somewhere around bubonic plague and horse manure. But what Mr. LaRouche said is that Congress can be pulled together to act because the crisis is so profound and the president's activities have been so disastrous. Now, I want to ask you if you picked up this week, Alicia, any reaction to, we saw it nationally, but reaction to the fact that the president is trying to save his disastrous Obamacare bill by postponing something that's written into the bill, namely the employer mandate. Are you finding that, this idea of the imperial presidency is sticking in the craw of some of the people in the Congress?
Yes. I mean, look, a long time ago, a lot of the more serious Democrats got a sense of that they were being used by this president to push policies that they may or may not have agreed with. And the fact that the president is choosing how to implement and when to implement something that a lot of people put their whole careers on the line to force down the throats of the American people has really created a bitter taste in a lot of these people's mouths. And that's not a very good thing, because it doesn't necessarily calculate into them saying, okay, we got to get this guy out of there. They're bitter. They're frustrated. They put their careers on the line for this person, for this guy, the so-called president. And, you know, they're being destroyed. And our fight with them is say, look, that's what we're up against. What did you expect? You're up against an imperial presidency. Don't get bitter. You know, you use your sovereign right as a Congress to get him out of there, and then we can take on whatever partisan problems we have. We can deal with that later. But you really have to be a positive factor in Washington, D.C., because Obama has made things so terrible for a lot of the Democrats, and obviously a lot of the Republicans who don't know how to outflank him because they don't really know what they're dealing with, you know? I mean, for people who are thinking like LaRouche, yeah, him doing that, of course he's going to do that. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about health care. He doesn't care about his health care program. What he does is what he feels like in the moment. So what I can say, I mean, the response to your question, Harley, is that there's a frustration, a gridlock frustration that happens when you even mention the word Obama for people.
Well, and we're beginning to see a shift because we're starting to see some bipartisan action. For example, with the Warren McCain bill, but also Rand Paul and Mike Lee joining with Senators Murphy from Connecticut and Udall from New Mexico on the Syrian arms question. There was bipartisan opposition to arming the Syrian terrorists. There's bipartisan anger over the FISA court and the NSA snooping, although I have to say there's also bipartisan support for it because you see people like Feinstein and others joining with hardcore Bush supporters in insisting that there's a need for this kind of snooping. Now, Rachel, I wanted to ask you something because you live in one of the states that historically has been one of the most strongest Democratic Party states. And it went for Obama both in 2008 and 2012. Are we seeing erosion of support from Obama when you go out and talk to people, for example, at this Democratic convention? Are you beginning to get some sense of that?
Yes, definitely. Many people now just say that they don't like what he's doing, but you can't trust any politician. That's one form of it is, well, they're all like that. Definitely this idea of the 14 years helps people go back a little bit. The fact that it was the Bush administration and Obama, we've had 14 years of a terror policy. Now, Guantanamo Bay was started by Bush. The war policy was started by Bush and happily continued by Obama. But anyway, yeah, just giving people a sense that it is the party structure itself and that is making it so that every single so-called leader in this nation is a puppet of something for an imperial policy, and that it's a war policy and it's an economic policy, and it's the same thing. And the intention is for genocide. Anyway, so just giving, really what people are responding to the most is having an understanding of what it is that we are doing as a movement, because it's obvious they don't see leadership anywhere else. But if we give them a sense of what we're doing, this bipartisan coalition that you're mentioning people acting out of line of character of their party, but instead, being willing to put everything on the line, like Snowden, for example, on behalf of their country, and that LaRouche is the number one person who's created the conditions for that to happen and is leading the way. Anyway, people just respond to people telling the truth right now. So, yeah, there's definitely a decreasing amount of support for Obama, and really just people opening their eyes in general, wanting a bigger discussion.
Well, on that, I wanted to ask you, because I know that you're very well aware of this because you've made this part of your campaign, but Massachusetts was the first place that actually applied a credit policy in the original colonies, and you just had a conference in the Boston area with Michael Kirsch, who's the author of a report on the national bank and credit policy. To what extent does this resonate with people up there? Is there still an awareness of the Pine Tree Shilling and the uniqueness of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, or is this something that's been lost and we're bringing it back to people?
No, there is. People don't as much know the Pine Tree Shilling itself, but they just have a sense that it all started here. There's a definite pride about that. It is very useful to provoke discussions in the State House about the difference between the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the British Tories, who are always here too. But
still there.
Still here. But people don't necessarily know all the names and dates, but it is still there. If you bring it up, there's a lot of people that say, yeah, my family was here, you know, this kind of thing. So it definitely does evoke a certain feeling in people. We just do have to elucidate on it and make them conscious of what the actual policy was, but it's definitely ripe for that situation.
And Alicia, in Washington, D.C., where, as we've seen the last 50 years, we've had a policy of monetarism, deregulation, free trade, environmentalism, and a shift away from production, when we bring up the credit policy as the means by which you revitalize the industrial, advanced agricultural sectors of the U.S. economy, does that resonate in these offices? Are people beginning to start recognizing why or that they have accepted false axioms?
Harley, we have a long way to go before there's resonance about what we mean when we say a credit system. Even the word credit right now is as if it were in a different language. So the work that Michael Kirsch has done has been invaluable. It's been priceless because he has these are historical facts that he's got, and the best way to make an inroad into the mind of some of these Congress people is with history, because some of them do know history. Some of them, you know, most of them have some established idea of the profundity of, you know, what we did. But very few people, I mean, if you think about it this way, the one most sabotaged part of the American history is what Hamilton did with the credit system, and it was the credit system that made us independent. It was the war, but it was the sovereignty over empire that, you know, maintained our independence. That has been the most sabotaged and destroyed part of American history. So we have to rebuild that very quickly for these Congress people and these policymakers. It's difficult in both the Democrats have their version of what they think we mean, and the Republicans have their version. So this is an uphill battle of rapidly educating these people that both sides of the aisle are dead wrong, literally dead wrong on their idea of global finance, infrastructure, investments, et cetera.
Well, and this, of course, has been the point that Lynn has made very forcefully in the last couple of webcasts and the last couple of discussions with the policy committee, that in fact, this is the fight we have to win, because as you know, 2 years ago, Glass-Steagall was something that was at best seen as an anachronism from the last century, and now it's at the center of a fight. So I guess what I'm asking you is, since we've won the fight on Glass-Steagall, at least to the extent that people now know what it is, or a growing number know what it is and are considering it, you can see the same thing happening with a credit policy, can't you, Alicia, from the work you're doing there?
Yeah, if we can sustain what we've done in terms of creating an environment and a presence, and this is throughout the whole country, which means the rapid education of the American people, too. I mean, the American people get Glass-Steagall because it happened 80 years ago. It wasn't that long ago, and most people were alive when we had a Glass-Steagall banking system, right? Really, no one has been alive since we had a true credit system. So what we're talking about is something very, very revolutionary in mankind's history. It's still incredibly revolutionary. And if we can, as a movement, sustain the environment where these ideas can move quickly through the circles that need to move, and if we can educate the American people to desire something more nobly than just getting their pension and then find they're out of the political fight, then yes, there's no way we can lose. There's no way we won't have a credit system. But it's people think the Glass-Steagall fight was tough. It's really just the beginning at this point.
Well, I think the point you made that it's been the most attacked part of the American system. I mean, Hamilton was killed over it.
Exactly.
Probably Lincoln and McKinley were killed over this question. John F. Kennedy may have been killed over this question. So it's not just that it's neglected, it's that it's openly attacked. And we've seen the open role of J.P. Morgan in fighting to keep Glass-Steagall out. So, you know, I think this is something that if the American people begin to realize that this has been the basis of our nation's development, and yet it's been kept from them, perhaps we'll see the kind of passion that's needed to overcome the ignorance. And Rachel, I wanted to ask you on this question that, how is it that we go out and organize around the credit policy? You know, a lot of people can talk about Glass-Steagall, the separation of commercial and investment banking and writing off the debt, and that seems fairly popular. But when you tell people we want a national bank, a lot of people don't know the difference between the Federal Reserve as a private central bank and a national bank. So it really is an educational process. So how do you bring that up, as you guys were doing today at the Democratic Convention? How do you bring it up in a way that grips people into actually taking up the conception?
Well, part of it, in a sense, isn't necessarily too difficult, just making the point that we do not need Wall Street for the real economy. That's really the fundamental issue. What is an economy without Wall Street? Well, everything that you need and nothing you don't. But yeah, just for example, I was speaking with a city councilman who, getting him to help with the Week of Action next week in D.C., and he said, to be honest, I still don't quite get the Glass-Steagall thing. And I gave the example that I brought up on the Monday show last week from the farmer Frank Endes at the San Francisco conference, where he said that between 1940 to 1952, we had a full parity pricing payment for farmers. They got 100% of what they needed to grow their food. And during that time, there was a recession in Wall Street because farmers didn't need to borrow money from Wall Street. So the real economy survived and flourished, and Wall Street went away. So you don't actually need Wall Street for the real economy. And the guy said, oh, okay, I see what you're saying. I agree with that. But beforehand, he'd just been saying they were two different things, farming and finance. But that, you know, that example just made it kind of clear for him. But anyway, part of it is just also just the spirit of the thing. I mean, we've seen this thing go on for too long. Wall Street, they're criminals. We're supporting criminals. If someone goes to the casino and loses a bunch of money gambling, and then comes to your house and says, hey, I lost a bunch of money gambling. You need to shut down. You need to shut down your health care. You need to eat less to pay for my losses from the casino. You'd say, hell no. You don't want me to pay your losses. You actually want to kill me. I guess there's a lot of different things that you can bring up, but really a lot of it is this idea of integrity, and that it was the identity that Roosevelt had, where he knew what Wall Street was, and he had the courage to take it on. And that's what we are infusing through using the population. We're infusing that spirit now artificially into Congress by our targeting the sentiments of this population onto Congress and forcing action. And it has also been successful. I mean, we also just got another signer from Massachusetts on last week, Stephen Lynch, who was at the hearing where Capuano brought up the question to Honig and Sheila Bair a few weeks ago at this hearing in Congress. And they both agreed upon questioning that Congress should pass Glass-Steagall. So now Lynch signed on, also with pressure from people in the district, as well as Markey, the new senator recently, upon pressure from phone calls. So, yeah, these things are all one and the same. We have to get the population involved in forcing Congress to take up these issues.
Well, Rachel, you just mentioned FDR. I wanted to find out from Alicia, to what extent is the policy of Franklin Roosevelt, or the sense of Franklin Roosevelt, still a living sense among people in the Congress? You know, you hear a lot from idiots who say, well, Roosevelt's the one who's responsible for big government and socialist government. Then you hear a lot of liberals who talk very favorably about FDR, but they don't know what his policies were. To what extent is there a living presence of FDR in the Congress, and how do we take that beyond just either hatred or hero worship and make it something real?
Well, I think the only way people really understand him, you know, currently, is for the reasons that Rachel just said, is that now that these Congress people are being confronted with taking on Wall Street, now they're beginning to recognize who Franklin Roosevelt really is and was. And you still get these lines, oh, he increased the federal deficit. But these things can be easily squashed with, well, yeah, he also won World War II and defeated a bunch of fascists from taking over Europe. And you get it less from the congresspeople, more from their staff, which is fine because the staff, you know, isn't really running the country. But the key thing to get right down to it with some of these people is you have to take on Wall Street. You're the only power in the United States that can do it, particularly because the president's not going to. What's your strategy? And then people through that avenue, people understand what Glass-Steagall is. And another way that we've made it more clear, and the spirit of FDR has sort of resonated around Washington, D.C., is in the last couple of weeks we've had some dynamite material on J.P. Morgan, fascist then, fascist right now. And you had this very compelling juxtaposition of what happened in Europe in the 1930s versus what happened here in the 1930s. And that makes it very clear for the Congress people, because when we say these guys are going for a fascist dictatorship, they'll say, oh, you can't say fascism. We say, congressmen, they've done it before, haven't they? And they said, yes, they have done it before. What did we have? We had Roosevelt. How did he deal with it? So there are a few avenues that you can get to these people, but it really takes our provocation and our agitation to get them to begin thinking in real terms and not just things that they've heard or, you know, populist lines. And that's our role, is to play this agitating role so some of these guys come to their senses.
And how do you deal with the other blind spot, which is the British Empire? Because again, last night, Lyndon LaRouche was explicit in this, that ultimately what we're dealing with is a deliberate starvation policy that comes from the Queen herself. And I know when Lynn says that, you get congressmen oftentimes, if, at least in public, will roll their eyes. And yet, it's easily provable. So to what extent are we starting to get across this idea that Obama is acting on behalf of a foreign power, the British Empire, which has a policy of not simply destroying the United States as a sovereign republic, but killing off a lot of its population?
Well, I'll tell you, the question of Obama being run by a foreign power is actually fairly well understood from both sides of the aisle. Congresspeople are beginning to get that, particularly, you know, because everything Obama's done has just been completely irrational and in no interest of any party or any layer of the American people. So that's a little bit easier. Now, identifying it as the British Empire is a little more tricky. And some of the most effective ways of doing it is, again, just going back in history. And, you know, for instance, a big delegation of our Congress are Irishmen. They have Irish ancestry. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to confront some of them, I have personally, saying, look, you're Irish. The British ran famines in Ireland and India, right? They killed people. It was deliberate. And you know what the British said then? They said that it was, oh, no, we didn't deliberately kill people. We were just following laissez-faire economics. This was the result of the, this is our economic policy. To a congressman, does that sound familiar? Mm. I say yes. So there are very real instances close by in history that we have to use to illustrate for these people that they are part of a legacy, and our enemies also have a legacy. And they can, you know, they already have an idea of it because they're in the Capitol, they're trying to write policy, they're trying to deal with Obama. They see how irrational and dangerous the situation is. But again, you when you walk into D.C., really anywhere, you have to have, you know, a good century of history in the making in your mind to be able to draw these congresspeople into history as it's being made right now. So, you know, from the financial aspect, again, the material we've had in the last couple of weeks, really the last month, has been very dynamite to identify this is London, this is the British. So it's not perfect, and it's still definitely, again, this is another thing, we have a long way to go before the Congress realizes that their enemy is this same British legacy. But there are a few ways to get the point across where it begins to stick.
But I think also you have to be driven by an intent, because in the past, one of the problems we've had as an organization is people have backed down under the initial incredulous look you get when you say something like the Queen of England runs Obama. And I think one of the things that's characteristic of the most recent period is the growing toughening of our organizers and being able to realize that people who say things like that are saying it out of complete ignorance or evil intent, and that we're driven by something different. And I want to use that to get to this question of what Lynn has been saying about the policy committee as a leading body. Rachel, as a candidate, you were then drafted to become, and I say drafted because I don't know that you actually volunteered, but the candidates from the last round of elections all became members of a policy committee, and Michael Steger out in San Francisco was added. And every week on Monday, you have a discussion with Lynn where the central themes of the week are taken up, but much more importantly, what you're beginning to see is a body develop as a deliberative process, and that's why Mr. LaRouche wanted the members of the policy committee in D.C. this week. Now, how do you personally see this development? I mean, you've been involved in it. Do you have a sense of the leadership potential that's coming from this group, and how are you going to take this mantle of responsibility when you go into Washington this week?
Yes, I think it is something that is a natural process if someone is trying to go out and organize personally, really putting themselves on a personal sort of, you know, you're putting yourself out there on behalf of representing the ideas of Lyndon LaRouche. And you have to, therefore, in a sense, embody the same quality of leadership that LaRouche does. That's, you know, a high standard to fill, but it also is very much necessary that you have a grouping of, or it's helpful to have a group that is engaged in a discussion. There is a reason why Plato wrote dialogues as opposed to just a dissertation, because there really is, you know, the best way of the most efficient way of making discoveries is through a process of dialogue, of listening, throwing in ideas, and you get a lot faster to something that's probably true. So that is probably what I would say about that process. It's something that I hope that everybody can be involved in, and they can through the process of organizing and trying to communicate these ideas.
Well, also every Monday in the afternoon, they can go to the LaRouchePact.com website and see the discussion, so that in that sense, they're participating as you and the other five members of the policy committee take up what each week is a new challenge from Mr. LaRouche. Now, Alicia, speaking of the website, you have a new feature that's just gone up, and I think last week was the first time in the recent period. I don't know if it's called LPAC in Action or something like that, but why don't you tell us about what you're trying to do with this?
Sure, yes. For the time being, it's called LaRouchePAC in Action, and we decided to launch this on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, which is basically a overview of, it's the bird's eye view of everything that policy committee is doing, our organizers nationwide are doing, our co-thinkers in Europe and around the world are doing, in a united front against a policy of imperialism. And we had the great fortune to launch the show covering the fifth in a series of Schiller Institute conferences, The New Paradigm for Mankind, the fifth called The Second American Revolution. Because when you pull all this material together and you see what we're doing as an organization, as a real living organism, and the people working with us, you realize that the American Revolution is not finished, and it's a global phenomenon, which is what the Founding Fathers had intended it to be. So the more we can reflect that back to people watching the website here in the United States and abroad, I think that people will have when they go out as an individual to go and fight, they'll have a little more confidence that they have, you know, there's a real impetus from the United States moving this thing forward, and that ultimately a system of empire doesn't have a chance, because frankly, you know, the Founding Fathers' ideas are far more compelling and interesting, and the ultimate idea is to give people a sense of the future, and that if you want a future, you're going to have to help create it. So that's the intention with the show, and we're always welcoming material that people have to feature in the show. So let that be a shout out for that.
Okay, well, we have just a little more than 10 minutes left in the program today, and I want to come back to the theme we started with, which is the Week of Action. And, you know, if you can just summarize again, Alicia, what we're planning on doing this week in terms of the drive into D.C., including with the policy committee, I think that would be helpful for people just to make sure that you get off this call and you don't just sit back and say, oh, gee, we're making some progress, things are looking better, now I can go back to my life. But we do want people to participate, and it's not to help us or do something for us. It's for you. It's for your future, your children and grandchildren. So why don't you give just an overview of what we're planning for this week?
Sure. I mean, for starters, I would just say that as a citizen going into Washington, D.C. and organizing your Congress, I've never experienced anything as fun as that, because it's accessible, it's possible, and with the right ideas and intention, you know, you can change history. So anyone who hasn't yet gotten involved, you're missing out. We have an incredible ability as citizens to do this, and
what we plan on doing next week is leveraging this incredible activist army that we've been building with, you know, twice weekly activist calls, material on the website, recruiting them to organize in their state legislatures. We're going to be leveraging these activists and bringing as many as we can into Washington, D.C. To back up the work that the policy committee will be doing. So this already includes several very high-level meetings. What's interesting about next week is that we got several meetings that we don't usually get when we make requests. And I think because there's the situation is shifting. I think also that people see Mr. LaRouche's role in leading from a policy standpoint as incredibly insightful. And it's one of the only things people can really lean on at this point, given what Obama's been doing and given the train wreck that the Congress, you know, usually is in. So we've got that already on the table. And then there's, you know, because Glass-Steagall and Dodd-Frank and what we're going to do with the global financial system is really such a hot item right now. There are a number of hearings with some high-level people testifying that will be in Washington, D.C., including our great friend Ben Bernanke. So he will no doubt feel our presence there as well and know that we are actively working to find him a new job, hopefully somewhere.
Get him out of his current one.
Yeah. Well, there's some opportunities in East Oshkosh, I heard, that are opening up that are going to be really good for him. So we'll, you know, and that's the effect we're going to be having, is that these guys, you know, through the Obama administration have for too long felt no resistance, no principled resistance from the Congress. And that's shifting, and they're getting that sense. And that's really the work that that we're doing there. So bringing the policy committee in is going to be it's going to be incredibly powerful, and it will be broadcast across the website throughout the week, so you can stay tuned to that.
And if someone wants to participate in it, to take part in the mobilization, what should they do?
Well, if you're not already planning on participating and you want to, you can. There's a couple of ways you can contact us. You can first either call 800-929-7566, which is just the contact 800 number on the LaRouche PAC site. You can email us at info@laRouchePAC@gmail.com, which is also on the contact page of the LaRouche PAC site. We make ourselves very available, but just again, remember, American citizens should not take for granted how what a powerful role we actually have as citizens. And at the end of the day, it's just fun and worthwhile. So I encourage people to contact us, and we'll have plenty of work for you to do.
And Rachel, are you going to be bringing some people in from Massachusetts? I know there are delegations from New York, New Jersey, and I believe Philadelphia, the Philadelphia area, coming into Washington. Will you have some people coming in from Massachusetts with you?
We don't have anyone coming in physically from Massachusetts. We've had a number of people calling to help set up meetings. We have a couple letters, and there will be people from Connecticut also.
So if someone is in Massachusetts or New Hampshire or Rhode Island, and they call their congressman and set up a meeting, they could get back to you through the number Alicia gave, the 800-929-7566.
Yes, that would be fine.
Okay, and look, this is what's important in this discussion is not the specifics of how to do these things, but that we're beginning to see an awakening in the American people. And it takes the form, usually in the United States, of a lot of griping and whining and complaining and victimization. But at a certain point, and this has happened repeatedly, at a certain point people realize that we are the government. This is our government, and if it's going off the tracks, there's no one who's going to put it back on other than us. You think J.P. Morgan Chase is going to put it back on the tracks? You think Big Oil or Big Pharma or the insurance companies are going to do it? And so I think that ultimately what you're hearing from Alicia and Rachel is this sense of purpose of people from a younger generation that came into political maturity at a point in which you see a completely bankrupt political and financial system. And the only place to turn is to yourself and to say, am I going to be part of the solution to this? So I hope our listeners have gotten a sense of that from the call today. And then, Alicia, I think the other point to make, and I'd like you to address this, is that it's actually not a burden or a sacrifice to decide that you're going to take responsibility for the human race, is it?
No. Like I said, it's some of the most fun, I think, that anyone could have. And I'll just say it again. I mean, we're really lucky to have the opportunity to participate in government the way that we do. If you have the right ideas, you can. And it's, I think it's, you know, just like you have a healthy diet for the body, it's probably the healthiest diet for the mind to be able to, you know, take responsibility and act on what everyone's endowed with, which is a conscience and the ability to reason. And we have a great advantage that we live in the United States, and that's possible.
Well, that's our Constitution, and as Lynn often says, that's in the DNA of Americans. You just have to make sure that it's brought out. And Rachel, let me just ask you, in terms of the policy committee, will there be a program this Monday?
Yes, there will be.
And then all of you are packing your bags and immediately afterwards heading down to Washington, I take it.
Yes, we are. And so I believe we will be in studio the following Monday for a live show then.
All right. So you'll be spending some time there.
Yes.
All right. Well, hopefully, look, we have seen significant motion, as I said, both on the negative side, and by negative, I mean people stepping up and saying they're not going to let Obama run roughshod over the Congress and make up his own rules. That Obama is going to arm terrorists in Syria, the same terrorists that have been shooting at Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq are now showing up in Syria, and Obama's trying to arm them. So I think we're seeing a reaction against that. But the important thing is for us to bring in the positive, the program that will work. And Alicia, let me just, the last question for you. I'm sure, coming from where you came from, the last decade of your life or so has been a real opening up of things that you'd never even imagined. But you're still, as far as I know, we're still having classes regularly. People are reading together, figuring out what it takes to make the American system function.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing you realize when you're confronted with having to take on Congress and change the current system is you have to know what you're talking about, and the education system doesn't really provide for that much now. So everything you do is a learning experience, and it's a lot of hard work. It's mostly hard work, good intentions, and a lot of hard work to figure out what direction should the country go in. And that's the real gem of this organization, is that we're based on doing just that, advancing culturally and intellectually the powers of people alive to forward mankind generally.
And Rachel, I assume that we're still bringing beauty to the streets of the Boston area with our chorus.
We are, and we've been having a chorus on Thursdays, which are, you know, other organizers can come to, new participants. And we're also bringing people into the Requiem project, which we're involved in on the East Coast. And
that's Mozart's Requiem.
Yes, Mozart's Requiem. And finding a lot of response, a lot of lovers of classical music and good culture all over the place that you wouldn't expect.
And your colleague on the policy committee, Diane Sayre, who's running for governor of New Jersey as an independent, is still lugging her trombone around with her and playing whenever she has an opportunity. Well, Alicia and Rachel, thank you very much for joining us today on the LaRue Show. Again, our listeners should make sure that you're engaged in this fight this week. This is a crucial week, and we can force a breakthrough provided we put the effort into it. So thanks for joining us today, and we'll be back next Saturday on The LaRue Show, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you want your friends to listen to this, it's archived under LaRouchePub.com. You can find the LaRouche Show on the LaRouchePub.com website. So again, Alicia and Rachel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Dan.